Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, and I've got my usual gang here. I've got Terry DeKester. Say hello.
Hello, all. The doctor of democracy is in. Sagacity is the prescription.
And Garland Nixon.
Hello.
Hello, I'm Garland. Back. And he's here.
Yeah.
So we
is
have...
the real Garland?
This is the real Garland Nixon, yes.
Oh, okay, good.
All right, so we've got a big show tonight. Today, I should say, because it's the afternoon. Even though it's so foggy outside, I'm not sure whether it's night or day here in Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C., nobody ever knows whether it's night or day.
That is true. We've got new gun problems. I don't know if they're new. Frankly, they're very old. But a new incident in Taft, California, where a 16-year-old boy shot another 16-year-old boy who he says was bullying him. And it took a teacher, a heroic teacher, to talk him down and to get the gun from him. The armed guard at the school was out that day. Apparently, he was tied in by snow. So what do you know? An unarmed teacher saved the day. Very, very brave teacher. I want to talk about that and all in the context of, well, what causes young men to go out and want to kill other men, because it's usually men. And also, of course, in connection with the National Rifle Association and President Obama's new plans for gun control. So there's a lot to talk about with guns. But also want to talk a little bit later on in the hour about Chuck Hagel and his nomination, and specifically with regard to him or not with regard to him, about what's going on in Syria. It's something we haven't talked about in a while, but the world continues even when we don't talk about it. And we three of us may well disagree on that one, but we'll get to that in a minute. So let's start with Taft, California. Garland, let me start with you. What were your thoughts when you heard about what was going on in Taft, California?
My thoughts are this. We focus on individual incidents when we have like 10 or 12,000 per day, and I think particularly now in school. But school-age children are gunned down on a regular basis, whether, you know, there are accidental shootings in homes, they're shot by, you know, robberies, drive-by shootings. So I think right now we are looking at individual incidents. The media, at least, is looking at incidents related to schools and reporting on them more because they'll get people's attention more. But I think that, you know, if you just look at any day and look at the gun violence, it's everywhere. So I don't look at that and I'm not, you know, astounded by that. That's unfortunately the norm, and it's going to continue to be the norm as long as this country says we are willing to accept random shootings, innocent people being murdered every day in return for being able to run around with any kind of gun that we want to have. It's the trade-off that we have, and apparently we're okay with that trade-off as a nation.
Terry, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, this is going to shock you guys, but I have come to the conclusion that the NRA is at least partially right.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Wait, are you on the? Is this Terry DeKester? Maybe he took a drug overdose. You know.
Well, it could be that, but I think it has a little bit more to do with research. You know, at least I hope.
I just thought maybe, you know, I know you're a '60s hippie, Terry, and maybe you just tripped on acid and suddenly you're supporting the NRA. What are you talking about?
Well, I can't go so far as to say I supported the NRA, but you know the NRA slogan, of course, it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people. Well, turns out in the people that they kill people idea is sort of right. The problem with the NRA and America, for that matter, is we never ask the question, why is it that our people, the Americans, are so violent and use guns the way they use guns? And part of it is very simple. There's many cultural reasons that we can get into, which are valid, but the simple fact is men are the problem.
Well, yeah.
Men are 10 times more likely to commit murder than women. 10 times. And it's not all men. It's particularly men between the ages of 18 and 24. That's the peak time. Between 18 and 24 is the peak time for men killing people, others, friends, family, school, children, whatever.
So we should lock up all men between 18 and 24? This kid was 16. Maybe we should go 16 to 26?
That's one solution. It's not one that I would necessarily
support. I mean, Terry, look, even though...
And just so you know, too, the next peak, of course, is men between 25 and 34. So between 18 and 35 or 34...
That's a lot of men.
That's a lot of men.
Granted that you're right that it's 10 times men over women. I mean, what are you proposing we do about that? I mean, it's again, we can't lock up 50 million men in the United States.
Probably not. Probably not. It would get even more crowded and abusive than it is.
Exactly.
The problem is, or maybe the solution is, you know, we don't face the reality of what happens to young men. And we don't educate young men or young boys before they become men on what is going to happen to them, how they are going to change, how the hormones are going to affect the way they think or don't think. And somehow that we need to, and I can't, you know, I can't put together yet a curriculum for it, but somehow that we need to educate young men in America what they are going to face emotionally, psychologically, etc., so that they are somewhat prepared for who they are becoming. And also, of course, pointing out somewhere within that process, you know, if they make certain choices, where that's going to lead later in their life. Will it prevent it, violence, and prevent gun? No, probably not. But it'll help, because men don't understand what is really going on in their minds, their bodies, their hormone changes, their emotions, that lead them to this uber-violent position.
Okay.
In this particular age.
Look,
range.
I'm happy to discuss all that, and I think we should. I do think that young women, girls, also have trouble knowing what's going to face them in life with their bodies,
yeah,
and so forth, that they don't usually act out violently, as you point out. But, you know, I don't think this is an American thing. I think there are plenty of troubled young men in Great Britain. Have you ever seen their soccer games? I think there are troubled young men in Canada and in China and in India and in Africa and in South America and Mexico. I mean, you name it, there are troubled young men everywhere. The difference, I argue, particularly compared to a place like Great Britain, is here young men have easy access to guns and then shoot. The troubled young men in Britain get in a fight at a soccer game, and that's not good, but it doesn't leave 30 people dead in Newtown, Connecticut. So I don't think the troubled young men is unique to America, but let me go to Garland and get his thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark, and I understand what Terry's saying, and certainly there are some cultural issues here. However, if I got to face an angry young man, I'd prefer to face one with a knife or a baseball bat than, you know, an AR-15. The reality is, the things we talk about, they're certainly there in other parts of the world. You know, there are people who talk about mental illness. Well, they got mentally ill people in Canada and Japan, where they had two shootings, I think, last year. And if you want to talk about a culture, I don't know how much you know about anime, but I mean, those anime movies and games are the most violent in the world. And, you know,
true.
They've got everything in anime in Japan. So I tend to think that when there are two discussions here. One of them is the culture of anger and violence. The other is, how does that violence transfer? How does that anger and how does that culture transfer itself from internal to massacres? Well, the way it gets the transferal point is through a 223 caliber Bushmaster. That's the transferal point, where people in a given country have whatever violent issues they have, and that translates into something happening. Well, it translates into mass murder here because they have the weapon. I mean, just look at it like this: if they could get their hands on a 50 caliber machine gun, they do a whole lot more damage.
Sure.
If they could get their hand on a tank, they do a whole lot more damage.
A nuclear weapon.
The more powerful is it. You gave them an F-18 on it. So when a person has whatever issues they want to act out, the more powerful an instrument they have, the more powerful their acting out is going to be.
I
disagree with you, Terry, simply because you give me something bigger, I can hurt more people.
I got good news and bad news for you. You know, one, I don't know if you've seen the advertisements for Arnold Schwarzenegger's new film, but that moron is using 50 caliber machine guns in his film now to blow everybody away. So we've gone way beyond the assault rifle. The next weapon of choice will be the 50 caliber machine gun. It's a little heavier, but you can still get it into a schoolroom if you want. And but you know, this is a cultural issue,
and
somehow we've got to deal with it as a cultural issue. Yes, this violence translates in other ways in other countries, but the real point is there's a decision process that happens way before that violent moment happens, and somehow or other we have to culturally and psychologically deal with that, and it happens in a very select group of people, not insane people. insanity, you know, that's a rough issue to push. I mean, when does it become insanity and when is it just action out of despair or whatever? But somehow we're not educating our society, our country, about our culture problems, about our social interaction problems, about where individualism leads, you know, on where this when you don't get what you want, take anything you can get. You know, this whole culture nourishes our violence way beyond any other society. And somehow we've got to deal with that. And the only way that I know that's possibly reasonable is educational. Yes, we can do some restriction on guns, but that's not going to stop it.
Well, let me push back and then partially agree. My quick pushback is you mentioned Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And, you know, 99.9% of people around the world, and these movies are seen around the world, not just the United States. Hollywood is seen around the world. 99.9% of people who watch an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie do not go out and buy a 50 caliber machine gun and take it to their school. So to me, to stop, and I'm not a huge fan of those movies, but it doesn't matter. To me, to stop something that's clearly a cultural phenomenon, a lot of people enjoy Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, and to say that because a million people enjoy it and one mentally ill person takes it as a mantra, and we're not even sure that happened, by the way, in Newtown or anywhere else. You know, maybe it happened in Columbine, but even that's not sure. To me, to strike down to say that we're going to stop this free speech that you don't have to like, but we're going to stop violence in movies because one in 10 or 100 million is going to act on it, to me, doesn't make any sense. But
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying you necessarily stop that, but you've got to deal with it and you've got to educate
how do you deal
people
with it?
About it.
I mean, when you say deal with it, to me, you're not going to stop Hollywood from making violent films.
That's not the goal. The goal is discussion with young men. This may come as a surprise to you, too. Most films today, and all violent films, are aimed at one specific age group.
Oh, I know, young men.
And that
I get
is
it.
19 to 24
right.
year old
right.
males.
All true, but the vast majority of them don't go out and kill somebody.
And you know,
the vast majority of families right now do go out and buy guns. Now, whether or not they're going to use them is a whole other issue, but they do go out and buy guns.
Go ahead.
Well, let me give you guys an example. Back in the 1920s, there was an instrument of death known as a Thompson submachine gun.
That's right.
That
machine
was,
gun Kelly used
basically
it.
Invented for military use. The military decided they didn't want it, so they decided, well, I know, we'll sell it on the street. So Al Capone and a number of other
Machine Gun Kelly was his name.
Determined that would be a great weapon for them, and they started buying. And at the time, there were laws. You couldn't carry a handgun around in Chicago, but there was no law that you couldn't carry around a Thompson submachine gun. So they started carrying them around, and they were shooting the town up, and that became the weapon of choice for gangsters, and they were just spraying 45 caliber rounds everywhere. People were dying everywhere. They were tearing the place up. They outlawed them. And guess what happened? The bullets being sprayed all over the place stopped. They could fire one or two. Back then they had, you know, six shooters. They could fire those, but they couldn't fire 1,000 rounds in a minute from a Thompson submachine gun. So the reality is we know that if you limit weapons, that will have an effect on violence. We can theorize what changing movies or video games, et cetera, may do, and the reality is there's no, you know, we don't know for sure what it will. We can theorize what it will do, but we know for a fact that if you can't get a gun, you can't shoot me. I say this. And the other thing is this. We can't change what people think or what people want to do. What we can legislate is what behavior they can create, they can do. So
we can change education, and we can expand education. I'm not against controlling guns. I just don't believe that in America that's ever going to happen. The lobby's too strong. The American sentiment is too strong.
I
the majority
disagree.
Of people don't want, you know, real limitations on guns. They're misled on the Second Amendment. So we've got to find an alternative if that doesn't happen.
Well, let me
and
say
what
this.
Is the alternative? Besides education. And education can change the way we think. If it can't, why do we have education?
I don't really care how the person, to be honest with you, I don't really care. You know, when I was in law enforcement, when I would say to officers under me, and when we came up with policies on things you could and couldn't do, I would say, look, I don't care how you think when you're off duty. I don't care what you believe. The only thing I can tell you is what you can and can't do. So what people can think anything they want to, and they can watch every all the most violent things, and they can have movies. I mean, they can have video games where they blow people with smithereens. I'm okay. I'm not thrilled with it, but I'm okay with that if they want to do that. What I'm not okay with is when they get their hands on an AR-15 and start spraying me and my friends and family. So
I'd rather
deal with the behavior that I don't like. And hope the culture changes.
See, I think reasonable gun regulation is possible, and I want to get to President Obama's proposals in just a few seconds. But I do want to agree with Terry on one thing. I don't think it's either or, but both and. We still don't know the details of what happened with the 16-year-old in Taft, California. I'm sure that's going to come out. He says he was bullied. Again, I don't know whether that's true or not, but let's take the young man at his word for a moment. Let's say that this kid was bullied. And to the extent that we could stop bullying in schools, that's a net positive, no matter what we do about guns. Just recently, the infamous American Family Association, which is really a horrible organization. They're the ones that sponsor the Million Man March, but as Ellen DeGeneres has pointed out, they don't even have 50,000 Facebook fans.
Is that Pat Dobson's people?
That is. They tend to be radically anti-gay. They recently came out against an anti-bullying campaign. Now, you would think that an anti-bullying campaign would be non-controversial, but it turns out that people who were trying to stop bullying were trying to stop bullying of all kinds, and including bullying against gay teens who are twice as more likely to be bullied as straight teens and actually 3 to 4 times more likely to commit suicide than straight teens. And the bullying, the anti-bullying groups have been trying to basically educate people as to what it's like to feel if you are being bullied. I know, Garland, you did a show recently on News Views about bullies. And, trying to educate people. And then this evangelical group comes out and says, we think you have a right to bully people for being different. And this whole campaign was about accepting. One of the things that they did is they had this campaign where one day a month you were supposed to sit with people you didn't know and introduce yourself to kids who were very different from you. You're supposed to go out, I guess if you're white, sit at the black table. If you're straight, sit with gay people. If you're, who do we lose there? Who we got?
I'm still with you.
We lost Garland. Yikes! Garland. All right, I'll have to get him back. I'll get him back in the break. But my point is this evangelical group was saying no, don't sit with anyone who's different. Don't interact with different people. That's just part of the gay agenda. Of course, it wasn't. I think we got Garland back. Garland, we lost you there.
Yeah, my call got dropped for a second.
All right, we're back.
Well, that's the NRA, trust me.
There you go. But my point is that, totally apart from gun regulation, the one part where I agree with Terry is that stopping bullying is, to me, an obvious good thing. Whether or not a 16-year-old turns to a gun to shoot back, he shouldn't have to feel that that's his only way out. A person should be able to go to a teacher and say, that kid's a bully, and the bully should be punished. Again, I don't know the details of what happened in Taft, if it's just in this guy's mind or not, but certainly we can stop that.
Let me throw in one other idea.
Yeah.
Our culture has one major philosophy, and that is failure is unacceptable. We have, from the military advertising Marines, be all you can be. You can be anything you want, et cetera, et cetera. That's our belief. And if you fail at that, you're obviously a loser. That kind of teaching leaves a young man or a young woman, but a young man no place to go when he encounters failure, except fear, frustration, resentment, et cetera. We have to deal with this cultural issue. Our cultural issue is absolutely insane. That's what's insane in this country. Everybody is going to fail. Failing, as we hopefully believe, is an opportunity just to change and adapt, and you can change and adapt. But we're not taught that. We're taught only one thing, which is be all you can be, whatever the hell you think that is. And that's insanity.
And frankly,
well,
I would say someone who's bullied is a failure.
The whole bullying issue.
Yeah.
While I agree with you that we should definitely have anti-bullying campaigns and do everything we can to address bullies, right, in the schools, on the schoolyard, what have you, I think we've got to be living in the real world, too. Let me tell you, I guarantee that if you go back to 1745 in, London or wherever the heck around the world, there were kids bullying kids.
Absolutely.
So, we've got to stay in a real world, too, where we say you address things such as bullying, but you recognize that one of the things in teaching a kid is how to deal with the world.
Yeah.
As opposed to being able to change everything. So to some, we're not going to turn things into a utopia. So And that's why, to me, they're two separate issues, because when it comes back to guns, what you're dealing with kids is conflict resolution. And most of the kids' times, the conflict is internal. They've got an internal conflict, anger, how do I deal with this anger, anxiety, et cetera. And what it comes down to is what tools they have. Well, if it's psychotherapy, what emotional tools do they help give a person emotional tools to deal with the problem? New emotional
simple
tools.
Question. Why do we teach anger management after somebody's angry?
But when it comes to real world things, there are tools also. What tools do we have to access that? Well, in 1645, it was your fist. You know, and now there are other tools. If you've got a gun, if you've got a knife, or what have you, I say we have to limit the tools that a person has to act out there. That's why I say I understand what you guys are saying when it comes to culture and bullying and all the other things that mankind has been dealing with since the time of fangs and claws.
But you do have to recognize, Garland, America is almost unique in the world in its level of violence.
I don't think so.
Whether it's drones or 50 caliber machine guns or AR-15.
I think if other countries had drones, they'd use them too.
Exactly.
That makes my point, Terry. Not to take over everything, but I'll make it this quick. My point is, there are a lot of other countries, if they had a nuclear weapon, if they had drones, if they had various implements of war, they'd use them because they don't like other countries or their neighbors.
What you're saying, Garland, is it's not possible to make social progress, and we know that's not true.
We have, as
a world, made social progress.
I agree with
education. We have changed. There's actually more peace worldwide today than there's ever been.
We're going to get to Syria in a minute. I don't think Americans are more violent mentally than other countries. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they do all.
They are actually.
Maybe in Sweden, people really do hug a lot and sing peace and love. But I think they get drunk and want to hit each other too. But the difference is that I think we have the weapons. As Garland says, we got the drones and we got the AR-15s that the Swedes don't have easily available. I mean, there was that horrible man in Norway who just shot all those young children. I mean, I talk about evil. I can't think of a more evil man than that one in a culture where those things are extremely rare because it's very hard to get those guns. He only got them because he was a police officer.
Wouldn't you guys at least agree that we need to do both?
Oh, I agree with that.
I don't think there's any dispute. And let me throw this in there. If you transfer what I'm saying to the military, I'm a firm believer that we have too much military hardware, and the fact that we have it makes it more likely that we'll use it.
No kidding. I think
we need less military hardware. I don't think we need as many aircraft carrier groups and all of that. And I think the more you have them, whether it's a gun or whether it's an aircraft carrier, the nature of human being is the more tools you have for violence, the more likely you are to use them. And I think it's a dynamic that is not an individual dynamic. It's a human being dynamic, regardless of the size of the group.
So let me move on to President Obama's proposal to restrict those tools. President Obama has said that he's going to make guns a priority. Of course, he's making lots of things a priority. We've got more fiscal cliff discussions and debt ceiling and so forth. That's coming in the next 2 months. He's got an overhaul of the entire immigration system, all of which are important. We're going to talk about those, I'm sure, on other shows. But Obama has claimed to have, if not an epiphany, at least clearly a change of focus after Newtown. Now, maybe because he's just won re-election and doesn't have to worry about the NRA so much anymore. But for whatever reason, for the good of preventing massacres like Newtown, or for the cynical reason of he's not running for re-election, either way, Obama has put forward proposals that I think, I disagree with you, Terry, I actually think these things are passable because he's not trying to ban guns. All right. He's trying to ban very specific things. He's trying to ban high capacity magazines. He's trying to say background checks for everyone who wants to seek to have a firearm. He wants to ban some of these semi-automatic weapons. To me, those are kind of reasonable gun regulations, are fun things that even most gun owners support. Let's start with high capacity magazines. I've had gun owners on my show who come here and they strongly defend the NRA, but they have to concede that if they're going out hunting, they don't need a 100-bullet drum. They call it a drum because it's so too big to be called a magazine. They don't need that to hit a deer. If you don't get the deer in the first two shots, that deer is gone. Hunters don't need these kinds of weapons. Can't we at least ban high-capacity magazines? Couldn't that get through a filibustered Senate?
I certainly hope so.
I think it could. I really do. I don't think we have to give up on those things.
And that's part of our culture, too, though. See, if we can enact any legislation at all, what we are saying publicly is there must be some restraint in our actions and in availability. And that, again, becomes a cultural issue. So I support that completely, and it will have an effect. But it's only the beginning.
I support it.
Did we lose Garland again?
I think we did. I don't know what kind of dance he's doing out there. I hope the NRA isn't near him.
I don't know. Maybe he's driving or something.
Yeah, maybe. He's joined the NRA and he hasn't told us.
I'm sure whatever he had to say was incredibly perspicacious. There's a good word for you. It was sagacious and perspicacious. But whatever it was, we have lost it. So Garland,
can you guys hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay, I was on my phone. So I hit a bad button and I'm fumbling around looking for to kill the mute button. And I can hear you guys talking. And but anyway,
Garland, we need to teach you how to work a cell phone. I know it's newfangled.
Yeah, because I've got my cynical comments are
yeah, but Garland, this is newfangled 1985 technology that you really need to figure out.
Yeah, I think you're right. But what I was going to say is this. You know, unfortunately, I don't think we could get, you know, if President Obama wanted a proclamation to say that, you know, the human beings breathed air, I don't think you could get through the House right now. I don't believe that we will get anything through the House right now because we've got people. If you know, I get the Tea Party. I went to the Tea Party's website so I could get their email.
Okay.
And when you read it, it basically says this. We sent these people here to stop President Obama. So you've got people there who think that, who believe that their commandment, I mean, it's beyond, it's like a theology, is to, quote, stop President Obama, since he and all that he stands for is inherently evil. Everything that he does or everything that he proposes is pure evil. So it must be stopped. To do good, you must stop. And so right now, anything that goes to the House, the only way anything goes through is if John Boehner gets the few Republicans that will vote and all the Democrats, which John
Boehner doesn't seem to have the courage or the ability to do
that. But wait just a second here. We've got just recently when the Republicans refused to take care of the relief for Hurricane Sandy. Peter King, a Republican congressman from Long Island, lambasted. I mean, really went after the leadership. The Republican went after John Boehner and said, "What are you doing here? You know, we've got hundreds of thousands of people who've lost their homes in New Jersey, New York."
So did Governor Christie.
Governor Christie did. And after Newtown, Connecticut, I would argue that even Republicans. Okay, not the Tea Party, fair enough. But remember, half Republicans are not Tea Party. And they, even Republicans, are saying not ban guns or anything like that, but banning high-capacity magazines. You got Gabby Giffords going around across the country and her husband, Mark Kelly, poster children for this idea that high-capacity magazines are a bad idea. You've got people in Aurora, Colorado. Colorado is a red state. That part of Taft, California, that's Kevin McCarthy. He's up in the Republican leadership. That's his district. These are happening in red districts. You really think, Garland, that despite all of that, this is just going to get buried by the Republicans?
I don't think it will. I don't think it will unless, you know, if Obama and Biden push it very quickly. If they delay it and mess around for a month or so, it'll be gone, and all we'll care about is, you know, what's her name, Loham, is doing. You know, it's got to be done quickly.
God, I think nothing gets through the house. So we shall see. I tell you what, Mark, here's what we're going to do. I've got a dollar.
Oh, no.
Oh, good. Money's on the table.
Oh, no. I still haven't gotten paid for the last one. Terry, you owe me $3.
I want you to run the tab. Run the tab, Mark. This is going to work.
I think your tab is done. I don't know. I get a check from Portland, Oregon. $3, dude.
I know. It defines our relationship. It's part of our love thing.
$3 for those who don't know.
I don't think
know.
Anything gets on any gun control magazine restrictions or anything gets through the house.
You know what's scary? Unlike the $3 I bet with Terry, $1 was on Obamacare and the other $2 were on the election. I'm not going to take that bet, Garland, because I fear you're right. So that's not a dollar I'm willing to put on the table. I hope.
We all want to be optimistic, but you know, what's going on in the house right now is scary.
Yeah,
it really is.
And if you've been bothered, I know for some reason or other, I've been reading the Wall Street Journal, and believe me, if that gets scary too, I want to tell you. Just the whole thought process.
I tell you what, let's take a break. When we come back, first of all, let's give out the numbers if people want to join us at 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is the Raucous Caucus right here on WEACT Radio, 1480 AM. We are here every Sunday from noon to 1. This is Mark Levine. I'm here with Garland Nixon and Terry D. Kester. And coming up after this, we've got a gun expert on the Inside Scoop. My show, we've got a terrific expert from a handgun control. He's going to talk about all the details of these guns, what they do, and how we can actually hopefully do what Garland and Terry and I fear can't be done. And
hopefully none of those guys are packing.
Reasonable gun regulation through Congress. So these are the good guys I'm having in my studio. And that's going to be at 1 o'clock, so you don't want to miss that. When we come back, I want to move on to the discussion, talk about Chuck Hagel, and also the situation in Syria, and whether we should do anything to help the people there. This is Mark Levine, Garland Nixon, and Terry D. Kester. This is the Raucous Caucus. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Garland Nixon and Terry D. Kester. Welcome, gentlemen. We are talking about guns. If you want to call in, it's 202-889-9797. But I want to move on a bit because President Obama has four new cabinet members, all of which are seeking to be confirmed by the Senate. One is Jack Lew, the new budget director. One is William Brennan. I think he's National Security or CIA. Forget which one he is.
CIA.
John Kerry, of course, Secretary of State. Those three, I think, are non-controversial. And for Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel. Now, Chuck Hagel is an interesting and rare character. He is a Republican, and as such has had some little damaging things to say, frankly, about a woman's right to have an abortion and about gay people. But he's also a Republican who, though he voted for the Iraq War, came very early against it, and he's someone who voted against sanctions against Iran. So a number of people on the left and the right are concerned about Chuck Hagel. Terry, what say you?
Well, you know, he's a fascinating character, you know, to begin with, and it depends really, in getting your information, it depends on who you read, just like your promo was saying there way back about facts. It's sort of hard to determine the facts regarding Chuck Hagel, and I say that only because Chuck Hagel seems to be a man, which can be a plus, of a man who thinks, which means he changes his mind. You know, anybody that's a real thinking person at some point or another is going to change their mind on various issues as they get more information. That scares the living hell out of Americans. We want people that just have one position and stick to it. You know, I think he might be worth the risk. I'm not sure that is the wisest choice that President Obama has made because of the controversy, but I'm very interested in seeing the hearings. I hope he can stand up and explain what his positions have been, and I hope people can begin to realize that a man, unlike, shall we say, McNamara or Donald Rumsfeld, a man as Secretary of Defense who can possibly change his mind on issues is a good man to have.
Let me throw out a few more facts, Garland, and then I'll turn to you. He is a Vietnam veteran. He certainly fought in wars. His most controversial things is that he very much opposed the appointment of the first gay ambassador, our gay ambassador Luxembourg. That was in 1996 with Bill Clinton, when he thought that the man was, I forget the exact words he used, but something like too gay or too openly
aggressively gay.
Aggressively gay, yes, yeah. Thank you. That was exactly the words he used, Terry. He also, by the way, opposed military women having the right to have an abortion. Even if they paid for it themselves, he was opposed to it. So those are sort of standard Republican principles. And that's what makes many on the left nervous. What makes many on the right nervous is that this is a guy that, though he supported the war in Iraq, came out very soon against it and is largely, and I think this is why Obama supports him, largely for cutting back on a lot of our military hardware, and a lot, I think he's also seen as less likely to intervene. He voted against sanctions against Iran, which I find troubling, because I think if you want to stop Iran without going to war, you got to support sanctions. So I personally am concerned about that. But a number on the right think that he's someone who will not intervene when we need to intervene. I got to say this. I think there are a lot better, more non-controversial choices. A guy like Wesley Clark comes to mind, who ran for president, who was Supreme Commander of NATO, who's a solid Democrat. There are other examples. I don't mean to just say him. But I think Hagel will probably slip through. But to me, he's using needless political capital that he could save on things like fiscal cliff, guns, and immigration. Go ahead, Garland.
You there, Mark?
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay. I support the choice, and I'll tell you why. Because he has a history as a non-interventionalist. Because he's a person who's been in he tends to look at things like this, and this is my interpretation of the things that many of the things that he said. Look, I've been in a war, and it ain't fun. And I wish all you guys who haven't been in war would stop trying to drag us into a war, because you don't know anything about it. And that sums up a lot of the things that he said about interventionist policies, number one. Number two, the people that strongly oppose him, Kenny Adelman, Bill Kristol, Pearl Wolfowitz, these guys, right off the bat, anybody that these guys oppose must be pretty damn good.
Hey, that's a good
point.
I like that.
They have been wrong about everything dating back to the Cold War. These guys, look at, you're talking guys who back in the Cold War wanted to engage in military action with the Soviet Union. They were wrong about Iraq. They were wrong about every single thing they've done. So if I don't know anything else about this guy, if I listen to somebody who's been wrong about everything and they say he's the wrong guy, I'm guessing he's probably the right guy.
It strikes me, though, that this is sort of a Susan Rice replacement. Barack Obama did not get what was clearly his first choice for Secretary of State, Susan Rice. And of the two, frankly, I trust Susan Rice more, maybe because I've seen her a lot recently as Secretary of the United Nations. She certainly knows how to be strong when it's time to be strong. She was attacked, and I think this was really a side issue because of what she said about Benghazi. When, if you want to blame our intelligence on Benghazi, fine, but Susan Rice wasn't in the intelligence department. She was merely repeating what the intelligence said. It seems to me that he didn't get Susan Rice, and so now he's sorry in Chuck Hagel. And of the two of them, I prefer Rice. I guess I trust her more. I'm not so sure where Hagel comes down on a lot of these things.
But, you know, I do think, you know, there's been misinterpretation of a lot of what he's done. Certainly, like, things like the aggressively gay objection that he had, or about the what he called an aggressively gay
man.
And
he did apologize for it.
That's kind of inexcusable. But simple things like the not paying for abortions in the military, it's also simply because the policy used to be if a woman got pregnant in the military, she was simply discharged so that she could have the child or whatever and not be involved in the military. And that's not a totally unreasonable
point of
view.
Well, no, wait,
there's
Terry.
A historical precedent
that. But wait. Now, come on. If a woman wants to keep her job and she wants to have an abortion to keep her job, you're saying, no, I'm sorry, you must have the child? I mean,
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying there's a historical perspective that has to be part of understanding where Hagel was coming from.
I understand, but it's an unfair history. I mean, I want to be fair.
And you got to throw this out. There has been no shortage of people in public office who have took stances on, gay people or on race or various other issues that people wouldn't be happy with, that at some point in their lives they said, that really was wrong, guys.
Well, Senator Byrd of West Virginia.
At the time in my life, it seemed like the right way to think, but when I look back, I was a dinosaur back then.
The other thing about Hagel, I mean, one of his fundamental philosophies that apparently he hangs on to in every situation where he is consistent is that engagement is necessary with adversaries as well as with friends. Engagement is necessary. And obviously that's true.
Engagement is necessary, but I cannot support his vote against Iranian sanctions. I mean,
it depends on the sanction, doesn't it? It wasn't all sanctions.
No, his vote was against sanctioning the government of Iran. And to me, if you don't want a war with Iran, you don't want them to get nuclear weapons, but at the same time, you don't support military action, to me, sanctions are the last step before military action. And to me, those were passed like with some 90 senators from both parties, and he was one of the few to vote against it. So I think there'll be a lot of questions about that.
Yeah, well, most of the senators
that.
Voted for the war in Iraq, too. I mean,
true.
Doesn't prove anything.
True, but I don't think either of you oppose sanctions against the government of Iraq.
Well, it's a priority thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and not only that.
Do you propose sanctions, or do you engage, or do you do both?
You do both, I think.
Yeah, but we never do both.
Right, but the other part of that is this. What are we tasking him to do? Are we asking him to be the ambassador to the Middle East? Are we asking him to be the decision maker on policy for Iran and Iraq and Israel and all these places? No, that's not what we're doing. We're putting a guy in a position and saying, this is your job. Your job is to run the military administratively, and your job is to enact the policies of the administration. So I think we get hung up on a lot of times on these appointments as though this person was going to make policy for the United States, when the fact of the matter is his job, and as a loyal soldier, as we've seen in Colin, one thing we've seen in Colin Powell, we've seen it in others, there are many times when an ex-soldier says, I don't like that policy, President, but I'm a good soldier.
Speaking of Colin Powell, I'd rather...
And that's what you get with it. Well, let me just say, and that's what you're going to get with a Hagel, I believe. You're getting a soldier who's going to say, well, you know, I don't like this president. This is what I think. And the president says, this is my policy. And they salute and they say, yes, sir. And they execute the policy of the administration to the best of their ability. So I'm not worried about his votes on this or that. I think he will execute policy. And I like some of the things about him as opposed to maybe some of the other people.
And the big question, and although we're not talking about it, is he got really solid administrative experience? And I'm not sure he has that.
Well, I'll tell you this. Sometimes the tail does wag the dog. Donald Rumsfeld, I guarantee you, wagged George W. Bush all over the place.
Yep.
So now I do think Obama's a stronger president than Bush.
Remember, Mark, I said the administration. Keep in mind, Donald Rumsfeld didn't wag the dog. He went along with, and the people I was talking about, Pearl, Wolfowitz,
right.
Cheney, these people were the administration.
Right.
And Donald Rumsfeld did, in fact, precisely execute the policies of the administration.
I think he actually supported them and went beyond them at some points, but that's a historical thing. We can get back to that. One thing I do like about Hagel administratively is I do think he wants to cut back a lot on the waste in the military, and on that he can do an excellent job, so I give him credit for that. We got about 10 minutes left. I do want to move on to the discussion in Syria. The three of us haven't talked about Syria in a long time.
In 10 minutes, we can solve all the problems easily.
Well, as you know, I think we probably disagree on this. I have felt the same way about Syria that I felt about Libya. I was very glad that Obama intervened in Libya, and I actually think Libya, for all its imperfections, is much better off now than it was before our intervention, and I think it's one of the most pro-American countries in the Middle East, despite the attack in Benghazi. To me, what's going on in Syria is because we haven't helped, and now they say at least 60,000, perhaps as many as 100,000 innocent people have been murdered, men, women, and children. This is, frankly, as bad as anything that Obama predicted was going to happen in Benghazi before the intervention in Libya. Because we haven't helped them, they are turning largely to al-Qaeda. Frankly, I can't blame them. If you're dying, you'll take anyone to help save you. And I would argue that we're going to get first of all, I think Assad's days are numbered. I don't say it's going to happen tomorrow, but I would say by the end of 2013, this man will be dead or out of power. Again, I can't tell you what's going to happen in February or November of this year. He's certainly holding on a long time. But when he's gone, we're going to have a radicalized country that is angry, that is mad at the United States, and frankly is a bunch of probably 10 different groups, some reasonable, some completely unreasonable, all with weapons. And Syria will descend into violent anarchy, whereas in my view, had we helped with a no-fly zone, again, not troops on the ground, but what we did in Libya, I think we could have had a relatively benign new Syria. It may even be too late now, but I still say that we should have aided the opposition with a no-fly zone, because you got to stop these massacres and we should be on the right side of history. But I think you both probably disagree with me. Who wants to start?
I don't disagree with you anymore.
Oh, okay.
I don't mean other issues. Of course I disagree with you. But on this issue, I don't disagree with you. Because I think, and this ties right back to Hegel, too, as all issues are intertwined, is when do we intervene and when don't we? And I think, you know, we've been overly patient, if you want to use that word. We've been overly reticent because of all the ties between Iran and connections with Turkey and everything else. It's a very complex problem, but it has gone so far that I think we should very boldly, very directly, and very openly say, okay, that's it. We're intervening.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm shocked,
Terry. You agree with me. Go ahead, Garland.
Yeah.
I think there's a factor here that we have to keep in mind. You know, one of the part of it is, you know, while we say that on the outside, we don't necessarily know what all is going in on the inside. One of the wild cards here is, in fact, Russia, because of their very close
friendship. They've had an alliance with Syria for 50
Assad
years.
Regime.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So but, I think that makes it a lot tougher, and I think that a lot of countries are more reluctant to engage because for a number of reasons. Number one, not just that people are afraid of Russia, you know, military action. That's not it. But Russia supplies a lot of oil to a lot of people in Europe.
But Garland,
there are a lot of countries in Europe that are afraid to cross that. And so I think there's other issues, you know, there are geopolitical and economic issues here. While we may say that's a great idea, you're probably not going to get a bunch of European countries to jump on board like you did in Libya. And then we're left, you know, by ourselves. So it's complicated. I don't necessarily disagree with you guys, but I think I don't see how we're going to get that done with Syria in the same way politically, because what happened in Libya was we had a lot of countries on our side to join in and work together, so it wasn't just us. How that's going to happen in Syria, I don't know.
Garland,
I think we could get some countries to help us and to be on our side. I think we could get some of NATO to do it, although NATO is a separate sort of institution, but we still have a lot of control over.
Oh, NATO would definitely do it. I have no doubt. The United Nations won't, but
you know,
NATO
but
will.
A point. There is a point, and I don't even like saying this, but there is a point when you have to say, okay, if we need to, we're going to the brink. Because you've got to, at some point, say, this is simply enough. And I think America as a country has to do that.
Garland, I think you overstate Russia for the moment. There's actually if you look at just yesterday, Russia called for a political transition process in Syria, according to Reuters. Now, they didn't say Assad should relinquish his power. I'm not saying that Russia wants us to intervene. They clearly don't. But I think that the idea that Russia would actually go to war to protect Syria is I don't think anyone believes that.
Even
Russia understands that you can't go around and use your own planes to massacre 100,000 innocent people and to be supported by the world community. That's just not going to happen. So even Russia recognizes that Syria is going to have a new future. And here's my concern. If we don't help Syria now, and again, as you know, I've been supporting this for a year or two now, so this is nothing new for me, and I realize it's very late now, but if we don't support it now, then when Al-Qaeda does take over in Syria and is frankly seen as the heroes of the people, Al-Qaeda was the only one to fight Assad, Iran was, Al-Qaeda stood up against Iran, then what are we going to do? Then the people who reasonably said, hey, I want the massacres to stop. I don't care who stops them. And then when Al-Qaeda attacks the United States and we retaliate, we're going to retaliate against the good people who frankly turned Al-Qaeda because we weren't there. I really believe the United States needs to be on the right side of history. Again, I'm never advocating U.S. troops, but a no-fly zone, because the biggest problem right now is exactly flight. It's the Air Force of Syria bombing its own people. They're winning on the ground, but they can't fight against the Air Force.
But aren't we supplying indirectly anti-aircraft weaponry?
You know, it's not clear whether we are or not. We may be doing that secretly.
I sure hope so.
I hope so, too. Officially, the proposal is we're just providing peaceful stuff, and Qatar and Saudi Arabia are providing some of this deadly stuff, but they're doing it not necessarily to our friends, to the democratic people of Syria who are fighting back. They're also giving it to, you know, Islamic fundamentalist terrorist groups and so forth. We can't control it when Qatar and Saudi Arabia are doing it. And I think the time for peaceful, you know, giving some humanitarian aid, it's long past. People are being massacred in the tens of thousands. It may well be over 100,000. And again, whether it's Rwanda or Cambodia, when people are being massacred in these large numbers, not combatants, but innocent people who are not even in the fight, I think the United States, yes, I'm sorry, I believe at some point we have to be a world policeman when we can feasibly do so, and I think we can.
I agree. I think we're at that point where we have to say, hey, there are times, you know, if the world community is not going to have a police force, and part of the reason it doesn't have a police force is because the United States prevents it, but that's another story. But if it's not, the world community is not going to do it, we're going to be the policeman. This guy is bad. He's out. That's it.
Well, I'm shocked that you agree, but Garland, I'll give you the last word on this.
I've got mixed emotions about that, because what we're talking about is the same policy as the Bush administration at a much lower degree. We're talking about degrees.
We're not talking about invasion. This isn't Iraq.
We're talking about intervention.
Yeah, but the other thing is that in Iraq, there was no revolution going on. I mean, there was no killing going on. The killing that went on in Iraq was during the Iran-Iraq War back in 1982. The government was not actively taking, rounding up its citizens and murdering them. So I think the situation in Syria is far more severe than Iraq. I mean, he was a dictator, but he wasn't doing what Assad is doing.
He was contained.
He was, and there was no active revolution. In this case, the people of Syria are going to overthrow their government. I'm convinced of that. It's just a matter of time, and I want to be on the right side of history.
And if the Arab Spring has any meaning at all, it's going to be destroyed if something isn't done to help Syria.
We're talking about our policy is interventionist, which I don't disagree that we should. I don't think we should never intervene. But at what point do we intervene? And that is a balance that I guess will be kicking around forever.
I'm sure that's true. Gentlemen, I think it was a very good, productive show. Tell us where we can find each of you. Garland, let me start with you.
Thank you. I'm on Facebook, of course, Garland Nixon, Twitter, @GarlandNixon, and then GarlandN@gmail.com.
And for Terry DeKester, the Doctor of Democracy, it's simple, DrofDemocracy@AOL.com. That's DrofDemocracy@AOL.com. We'll solve all the problems.
And we are the Raucous Caucus. We are here at WEAX Radio, 1480 AM, every Sunday from noon to 1. You can check us out and listen to our unique banter and so forth. Coming up in the next hour, we've got a terrific expert on gun regulation.
Am I still going to be with you in the next hour?
You want to stay on?
No, I can't. I can't.
Okay.
But I just thought you said expert, so I was just ready.
No, it wasn't you. His name is Omar Samaha. He's terrific. And we're going to have him, and you're going to join us. And that's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine. And you won't want to miss that, because he really is going to teach us a lot about guns and about what we can do to stop some of this needless violence. So hang on for the Inside Scoop coming up right after this break. Thank you, Garland.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Terry.